time. We're back on recording here. We had a nice break here too, and then we were back at trying to figure out how to express how high this stupa is. I could just read it and say it's really high. That there's a description of the I guess the universe we can think of as being divided into the three realms, and there's the desire realm, and then there's the form realm, and then there's the formless realm. It's sort of the form and the formless realms are much more refined states. We're in the desire realm, but the form and the formless realm are much more refined states of consciousness, and they're inhabited by deities. And so then we were talking about this large mountain in the middle of the universe, right? And the world is sort of based around this mountain. And then you have at the base what we call demigods, and then you have the deities of the desire realm. So there's these gods of the desire realm, and then up higher than them are the gods of the form realm, and then the gods of the formless realm. So when we're talking about obviously we're not thinking of putting our stupa in the formless realm, So then we're talking about getting up to the height, the top of the form realm, And so it's a really high stupa, and but then sort of that comes into question is, well, if I'm going to be interested in Buddhism and be a Buddhist, do I have to accept, that there are these unseen abodes of deities and so forth, and this mountain in the middle of the universe and so forth? So it's a question that comes up a lot when His Holiness the Dalai Lama is teaching. And you sort of have to go back to one of the primary teachings of the Buddha is the four reliances, and he says you have to rely on the teaching, not on the person who teaches. So because the Buddha was instructing his students, you don't have to follow what I say just because I say I am the enlightened one. You have to follow what I teach and subject it to your own analysis and with an open attitude. There's this other teaching that Aryadeva has in chapter 12 here, where he expresses this idea of the ideal student. The ideal student has, there's three qualities, but the important quality we're talking about in here is to not be partisan, not to think, well, I'm Buddhist, and therefore this is right, and nobody else is right, and I have to follow this. That's not the way Buddha wanted his disciples to learn his teachings. He wanted them to subject them to their own analysis. Why would he want them to do that? So that they can develop their ability to analyze, to critique, to use their... This is a very important quality. I like to use the word intelligence, but it's really wisdom. It becomes wisdom, and it has an analytical quality to it, that you're able to critique and analyze and see things from many different sides. It's what it really means. You're not just looking at the one side because I am a Buddhist. You're keeping your mind open to all different disciplines, and you're analyzing what the Buddha said with some kind of a good method of analysis. And over the centuries, the commentators have developed these ways of analyzing. I don't think I'm going to go into detail on it, but there's different... basically, there are things that are very obvious to us. There's different kinds of things that exist. We can say different levels of objects. There are things that are very obvious to us that we can see with our own eyes, and we can understand through our senses directly. And then those are called, what do you say, obvious phenomena, right? For lack of a better, they're the ngungir, means manifest, is another way of looking and translating that. They're just manifest to us. We can see, that's a chair, direct perception. Yeah. They're objects of direct perception. They're our own, they're not really objects of our thought. There's something that we can understand through our senses. Then there are things that are hidden to our senses, okay? So then we have to understand those through what we call inference, just using our ability to infer the existence of things, right? And those two methods are very valid ways of understanding something. You can understand something that's hidden to you through a process of reasoning it out, okay? It's like if you saw smoke over in the distant building, you could think, whoa, I got to get over there because there's a fire there. But you don't see the fire, right? But it's a reasonable assumption that if there's smoke, there's fire. So that's the idea, that it's hidden to you. You can't see it. You can't detect it with your senses. But you better get over there and put it out because it's there, So through inference, we can come to a firm... certainty that something exists. Okay, there's not a problem there. Okay, the very hidden, then the next level of phenomena is, it becomes a little bit more difficult, and so then you have to rely on scripture, and then you have to analyze the scripture, okay, and see if the scripture is correct or not. If the scripture happens to express things that are obvious, that should be, phenomena that you should be able just to see, right, or to experience through your senses, then it shouldn't be contradicted by your own senses, okay? Like, for instance, and that's where this whole idea of why His Holiness says, well, you don't really, he has no trouble with this, okay? He just says, as there's, scientists have gone around the universe and sent out probes and used all sorts of methods that extend our senses, really. These are all ways to extend our senses. And they haven't found this Mount Meru. There's no evidence of a large mountain, and in the middle of the universe, and so then it's sort of like our senses then contradict this teaching, which is part of a scripture called the Treasury of Knowledge, written by Vasubandhu. I was talking to somebody about Vasubandhu earlier, and. But Vasubandhu was a great scholar, and so then when people ask His Holiness says, I revere you, Vasubandhu, but this description of the universe, I don't agree with, because it's just, there's no evidence for it in based upon, this modern scientific extension of our senses, which they didn't have in those days, of course. So then that scripture then falls, you know, is you're trying to say that this scripture is correct because it doesn't, our senses, our sensory perception doesn't contradict it, but there's no way to do that. So then you have to not accept this particular scripture because it can be contradicted by what our senses tell us, okay? And so then His Holiness has no problem with saying, you know, that you have to, you know, accept set that aside respectfully, because, you know, Vasubandhu was a great scholar and he had a lot to say. You can't just sort of throw out the whole. You have to then, you know, see what else was said in that. All the teachings on karma, for instance, are in our actions and the effects of our actions are really in that book. And so that you don't just throw the whole book out, but this description of the universe, well, you know, it had its purpose in those days, but, you know, you'd say, well, it was provisional. You know, the Buddha taught this provisionally. It wasn't like the ultimate or the definitive teaching that he was interested in. And so then the question arises, well, what was the definitive teaching, right? And the definitive teaching is then the teaching on the nature of reality, the emptiness and dependent arising. These are the teachings that then we have to turn our attention to with great focus. And that's why His Holiness emphasizes understanding emptiness, okay, the philosophy, because once you understand emptiness and you see, understand the teachings on emptiness and dependent arising, the two truths, really, it's talking about in Buddhism, there's the ultimate truth of things. We accept everything the way it appears to us. Okay, it just seems we accept things at face value without any questioning. We're kind of like unquestioning about it. When we're born, we're given a common way of understanding our universe, and we all, you know, accept that that's the way everything is. And universe, in meaning for a small child, just all the objects and people around us and ourself, you know. But then Buddha said, well, no, you know, you have to question the way things, appear to us. You know, we actually got it wrong. I mean, we all have it wrong right from birth. And so then the question of these two truths come in, that things are always going to appear to us, you know, in a kind of conventional reality or conventional way, to have this, have an independent existence. They seem to exist on their own, okay? They have to seem to have some kind of independent way of existing, and also they seem to be, I'm forgetting, I learned a new word for this, but they seem to be, you know, out there, you know, they seem to be, you know, separate from the consciousness, our mind understanding them, okay? They seem to have their own separate, independent existence, and that's just a mistaken appearance, okay? That's in Buddhism, that's not they don't have that. They actually lack this way, that kind of way. They could never exist in that way. And so then this lack of existing in the way that they appear is what we call emptiness. And actually the way they do appear is they are dependent phenomena. They're dependent, you know, things come into existence dependent upon causes and conditions. They don't. Everything's causal, and so they can't have this kind of independent existence that they appear to have. Let alone that they're dependent upon our mind that's perceiving them. And so how can they have this independent existence that they tell us, you know, that they are broadcasting, I'm here independently existing, you know? And so that kind of independent existence is a false appearance, and that's their conventional truth, okay? Truth is kind of, we'd have to put it in quotes, right? Because it's not really true. They don't exist the way they appear. They couldn't exist the way they appear. Nothing could function if it was autonomous and couldn't interact with anything else. Because everything is constantly interacting, right? And therefore it exists. because it does have a dependent existence. So, but then we're always accepting this independent existence, and so then the Buddha taught this, and this is this teaching of the two truths is something that that if once you understand how the two truths work together, that things can totally lack the kind of existence that we ascribe to them, and still function, okay, still work, okay, and because we're convinced that in order for things to work, they have to have this independent existence and to exist outside of us, independent of us, and so forth. And so then when you start understanding that, then the two truths are an accessible teaching that we can become certain about, and so then, you can reach some degree of certainty, and in Buddhism, there's various degrees of certainty. We started talking about them, that you can reach through inference and through direct perception, right? And so those are the two they're called valid cognition, you know, the valid ways of understanding things. And that means that the understanding that we reach through those two ways of understanding things is incontrovertible, okay? Incontrovertible means that we're not at all being misled, okay? It's the opposite of being misled. And so we're having valid, cognition of whatever it is we're trying to understand. So, how did we get here? Where were we? Well, I'm telling you, in terms of what the Buddha taught, right, and how we approach it as new Buddhists, okay, His Holiness is stressing understanding these two truths. That's why in the summers, when Keshe Shitapake comes, I ask him to teach the later chapters of Aryadeva's 400 verses, because he has a very good way of explaining the teachings on emptiness. He's very well versed in them, and hopefully through studying what he said, they're available on our website. In the resources section of our website, you can hear what he said and hear my translation and read the transcript. That if you study those teachings, then you reach some understanding of the two truths, then this forms a way that you can then continue your understanding of what the Buddha taught. We have understanding what the Buddha taught, it can, for new Buddhists, has to begin there, according to His Holiness, but not just His Holiness. His Holiness is just speaking for a tradition. And traditionally, new Buddhists are encouraged to approach it that way from the time of the Buddha, but particularly the Buddha's disciple Maitreya. Maitreya, the future Buddha, emphasized this for new Buddhists in one of his treatises called Ornament of Clear Realization, Rindokgen. And so then if you... So if you start with these, if you get a good understanding of emptiness, really is what His Holiness, it's really talking about. Once you get a good understanding of emptiness, then you're going to understand how dependent arising works with emptiness, and you're going to get an understanding of the two truths, okay? And how our ignorance, you have to, in connection with that, you have to understand how our lack of awareness about how things exist, you know, causes this misperception to create a lot of havoc for us. All of our suffering, in fact, all the difficulties in the world come out of this whole problem. We were talking earlier about science nowadays is coming to, you know, a very parallel understandings of reality. But the Buddha said 2,500 years ago, but they don't put it in a system where it's related to our suffering and getting out of our suffering. It's just the Buddha who shows how that creates our whole world, in fact, and it creates, and it's a world that we're creating from a misperception. We're actively seeing things in the wrong way. It's a misknowledge. We're making the mistake of accepting the way things appear to us. You know, we're just accepting, oh, this is the way it is, you know, without any questioning. We have to question, we have to analyze, we have to be that ideal student who approaches things with a critical analysis and to develop their wisdom. And it's wisdom then that penetrates into this delusion. We're actually, it's a delusion. We're misled by the way things appear. And we're just sort of like, oh, it must be that way. And Buddhism, the Buddha taught these truths, okay, that are the opposite of the way we just sort of accept things. You know, there's many, you know, we see things as being, one obvious thing is that we see things as being very static, right? Whereas everything appears to us to, you know, have a, we might know that eventually it's going to disintegrate, right? That the, you know, this house won't be here forever. But it certainly seems like it's here right now, and it's not going anywhere, you know. But you know, and that's the. But if we even in our science, from our scientific background, we have this idea that it's in a constant state of flux, you know. That because on the atomic level, it's never really sitting still like it appears to, right? So we have this idea that's very similar to the Buddhist But then we go in and we're very dependent upon creating the world of static world. We become very dependent on, well, this is the way it is. We sort of accept that that's the way it is. But in fact, that's not the way it is at all. And so we get in all sorts of trouble, you know, when suddenly things change. You know, in a radical way, even more, right? Because we're not at all prepared for sudden change, and in fact, we don't like it.
No, we don't.
We do not want change at all.
The car's broken.
So it's like that, and so then it causes us all sorts of suffering, and this is what the Buddhists, you know, the followers of the Buddha, are concerned about: suffering and overcoming it. You know, and then. And it causes us a lot of trouble. our misperceptions of our world and accepting the way accepting and these delusions is very destructive to ourselves and those around us. So anyway, where are we? And we're not at 9:25. Let's say
how about
2:30. Yeah, right. Something happened to this clock here. So anyway, that's something that we have to keep in mind, is that if we're going to be serious about studying Buddhism, we have to really make a lot of effort, as His Holiness says, to understand the teachings on the two truths, or he puts it just understanding emptiness, understanding the teachings on emptiness. Dependent arising is another way to say it. Mm-hmm. Dependent origination is another word used. Understanding the teaching, because dependent origination describes how things do exist, that they have this dependent existence. And then the fact that they have this dependent existence means that they lack this independent existence that they appear to have. You can think about the chair, for instance. That chair, we know it was put together by, you know, many different causes and conditions. But once it's put together, it just doesn't seem like, you know, it doesn't appear to us to have to need those causes and conditions. It's sort of like, I'm here now, you know. I didn't need all those things, and I, you know, I created myself, you know.
That, be here forever.
Yeah, and I'm going to be here forever. You know? That's the way it appears to us, you know. So then it's talking about looking beyond, okay, the way things appear to us. That's what the Buddha says we have to do. And so in that case, then, once we, then we can sort of understand the existence of things that are hidden to us, okay? Like the teachings about the deities and how long they live and how and where they live and so forth. We have some way of approaching, you know, things that are hidden to us, okay? With some kind of open analysis, because we can say to ourselves, well, the Buddha taught these two truths, and those are certainly correct. And why would he, you know, why would he then deceive us about other things, you know? And so then there is one verse in chapter 12 that sort of encapsulates that approach. I think it was 280, maybe. Yeah.
Verse
280 on page 241. Whoever doubts what the Buddha said about what that which is hidden should rely on emptiness and gain conviction in him alone. On the bottom of page 241. So whoever doubts what the Buddha said about that which is hidden. So when you have trouble with these teachings that are more hidden to us, okay? What hidden here means very hidden. It's really just talking about the things that you have to rely on in terms of Scripture. And there's a whole way of analyzing Scripture that I'm not going to go into, but just you can analyze it with... And come to a firm inference that this is a valid scripture, okay, and that's what you have to do. I mean, Buddhism is not an easy thing to come to a really firm certainty about, certain knowledge of. You have to be studying and studying and studying your whole life, like. Our teacher who comes in the summer, you know, he's just a dedicated scholar, and he knows the scriptures. You know, he pulls them all down. He's memorized things, and he pulls them all off the shelves and puts them all together, and writes, you know, papers, and still he studies more and more and learning more and more. You know, there's like no end to studying. When you think about it, it's in order to know everything, you have to learn it, you know, and it's not suddenly going to come out of nowhere, you know, so you have to keep studying. And he's a good example or a good model of that approach. So maybe we can finish up Aryadeva's verse here. So then he's talking about how excellent the merit, how great is the merit, that means, of one who trains others to develop the spirit of enlightenment. It's just much greater than this huge, you know, monument that we can imagine, you know, that's so vast and so high, right? Doing that and covering it all with jewels, you know, and covering it, you know, using the best, you know, precious stones and so forth, the merit of having this spirit of enlightenment. I mean, fortunately, we don't all have to go out and build these stupas, you know. but it's still very hard to develop this attitude of the altruistic spirit of enlightenment. And so then it says, it's like the following analogy. A man died, and one of his friends cremated his body, while the other looked after all his children. And so it's saying, you know, looking after over his children is much better, right? Just as this was best, the merit of causing others to generate the intention to attain supreme enlightenment or the spirit of enlightenment, so that the Buddha's lineage may not be broken, is superior to cremating the body of a Buddha. So cremating the body of a Buddha, it's talking about making, you know, making relics that then you're putting in this magnificent stupa, this huge stupa. And then it's saying that to generating this supreme, well, this intention or this altruistic and desire to attain Buddhahood for the sake of others, right? To become enlightened for the sake of others is greater than that. And then if you do that, if you help train others to do that, that's the way you're going to continue the Buddha's legacy. You know, the attainment of enlightenment, of Buddha's enlightenment, the main cause of that is this mind, this altruistic intention, or this altruistic intention to attain Buddhahood for the sake of all beings, you know, that spirit of enlightenment, we call it. It's the main cause of becoming a Buddha. That if you have that kind of attitude, then you're going to become enlightened at some point. And if you have that attitude, you're known as a bodhisattva. You're called a bodhisattva. That is the attitude of a bodhisattva. And so that's the way you're going to continue the Buddha's legacy, right? And that's much greater than, you know, just cremating the Buddha's remains and building a stupa. There's so much more merit in that. So many more good causes created by that than by building a stupa. So the next one is, how do bodhisattvas act to benefit sentient beings? So now we're talking about the bodhisattva, the one who has this kind of attitude. And so if we look at the outline to get, what is this actually talking about? Well, we're changing topics. If you look on page 313, it's the actual mode of training in the deeds. I'm not a fan of the word mode. You can think of mode as the way. It's the actual way of training in the deeds. Physical and verbal conduct and acting for others' welfare. So how do you act? How do you act physically, and how do you speak? In acting for others' welfare. So in that case, then how do bodhisattvas act to benefit sentient beings? They act according to those beings' dispositions. Wow, what does that mean? You know, to their dispositions. They act according to their dispositions. A spiritual guide who wishes to help must be attentive towards students. They are called students because of not knowing what will benefit. So we're students of the spiritual guide because we don't know what is the best thing to do. And so the spiritual guide has to show them what is the best thing to do. So a spiritual guide who wishes to help must be physically and verbally attentive to students in keeping with their dispositions. They are called students because they do not know what actions are of benefit and need someone else's advice. Just good advice a bodhisattva is benefiting others by teaching them what to do physically and verbally, right? And the bodhisattva, how does he or she do that? By in keeping with their disposition. Disposition is a word that we render the word samba. Sometimes I like to think of it as just their way of thinking. You know, you have to explain the teachings that accords with their way of thinking. Okay, samba just means to think. Actually, disposition sort of. I don't know what disposition. It's sort of a general term, you know, that talks about a person and how what they're disposed towards. You know, what are they disposed towards? Mm-hmm. You know, and so then, I think His Holiness, for instance, is taking up this. We think of His Holiness as a good His Holiness the Dalai Lama as a good model of the bodhisattva and what the bodhisattva does and. And he's always professed an interest in science, and the world has been definitely very influenced over the past few centuries, right, by science and its discoveries. And so then he urges people to study science, know what science is saying, and to that if you're serious about understanding the Buddha's teachings, that then you have to have this scientific approach as well. You have to bring the some knowledge of what science is discovering about the brain and so forth. And why would that be? Well, because we're disposed to that from a very young age of thinking everything about things in scientific terms. Are we not? You know, it's hard for us to get out of that. That's the way our culture and our training, our education, right, has proceeded. So then it's going to help us to much more to think in terms of the way we are disposed, right, our disposition, the way we're disposed to thinking about things. And so there's some very good books about Buddhism that I'm reading one now that called 12 Examples of Illusion, that where the author Jan Jan Wester something is another syllable there. He's taken all this scientific, all these thoughts about illusion and related them to the Buddha's examples of illusion. And I think it's a really, he's sort of taking what His Holiness is indicating, to use scientific discoveries and ways of thinking in order to us to approach these different classical examples like, magician's illusions and what are we calling it? you know, figments of somebody with an eye disease, and you know, all these, he's taking them and putting them into a perspective of what science is,
today?
Yeah.
Science.
What science would say in relation to this. And it's sort of, what it gets you to do is to think about illusion, you know, and open you up to the idea of illusion in a way that is you know, accords with the way we think, because we don't think in terms of, like, you know, we always have trouble with this idea of the magician and creating some kind of a mass
hysteria,
not hysteria, what is it called, mass hypnosis, right? It's kind of like a mass hypnosis is the only way we can relate to it, but it's important to know it, but in order to understand what the Buddha said. But if we think in these other terms about how we are subject to illusion in other things, is what he said. Illusion is something that's very common to us, and so then he points it out in other contexts, how we are subject to illusion, you know, and in relation to that kind of misperception. And it illustrates the examples quite well. I think you did a good job.
What was the name of it again?
12 Examples of Illusion. So I would recommend that book in that vein, right?
Like Jan West or something.
Jan Wester, yeah, something. I still didn't get it.
Okay.
So it says...
Wester Hoff?
H-O-F-F? Oh, Wester. Okay, thanks. Thanks, Fred.
Sure, he has Google in his fingers.
Yeah,
or Amazon.
He has the book on his shelf.
Oh, he's got it.
Yeah. Then, so an elephant is made submissive by first giving it sweets and sugar cane. The training hooks are used on it later. This is an example of this idea of, you know, if you're going to get somebody interested, first you have to do something according to their you know, disposition. They like, you know, they like candy and so forth. What did you say? Sweets and sugar cane. And then training hooks means then it's not like you're going to get clobbered later. It means then you can get into learning, you know, and training your mind. And so it's like the following analogy. Through miraculous feats, the Buddha gradually took care of Uru Vivalva Kashyapa.
Okay.
Took care of. It sounds like Uru Vivalva Kashyapa was sick. However, that's not what I had to look that up. It's just, Jesus Sungwa means, take care of means to guide somebody, to lead somebody. Okay, in that sense. Now, how did the Buddha lead this person, led this person through, you know, what appealed to, and that's why today we're talking, I was talking about, this is the 12th day of the Buddha's miracles.
Right.
And so then the Buddha taught these miracles so that people could, you know, that's what appeals to people. Like a friend of mine, he's very, very, what do you say, devoted follower of Christ, but he said, well, show me a miracle, you know, he wants like a miracle, right? So, you know, because he questions, he's a very questioning guy, but it's like he wants to see, he wants the, you know, somebody with authority.
He knows.
Yeah, and he wants somebody to do like Christ, you know, and then maybe I believe in God, you know, he's very questioning about the belief of God and so forth, and so show me some miracles, and then that's the attitude of a lot of us, you know, we've heard that a lot. It's not like all of us have that attitude.
Show me the money.
Yeah, show me the money. Like that. But anyway,
it's strange because it's almost like show me something beyond causation.
Yeah.
Hello.
Yeah.
So then, But, you know, we have great conversations. I mean, he's enjoying, you know, developing his, what we call, critical awareness, you know, and you know, it gives him some feeling that he's making some spiritual progress. And so anyway, so you have to do something according to the person's disposition in order to guide them. And that's how the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, well, the Bodhisattvas we're talking about now, that's what they do. Accord with their thinking, the way they're thinking. These are really famous verses, by the way. This next one is also a very fantastic verse. Very fantastic. It's just real, and that's hyperbole, but it's a great verse to remember. You think, right? Even if students are recalcitrant, one must endeavor to overcome their disturbing emotions. Okay, so here we're talking about... what does it say here? If we go to page 313. We're talking about analogy showing one must be compassionate towards a recalcitrant person. Okay? Somebody who's really recalcitrant. I tried to look up this word recalcitrant in the Tibetan, and I have no idea what the Tibetan means. It's a very strange word. So, sorry, I couldn't. I'm accepting what the translator came up with. Recalcitrant, it won't work for me. So then, just as a physician is not upset with someone who rages while possessed by a demon, subduers see disturbing emotions as the enemy, not the person who has them. Isn't that marvelous, right? I mean, subduer means a Buddha, okay? And the Buddha, Buddha doesn't blame the person, okay? The Buddha blames the affliction, whether it's anger or hatred or whatever. He blames that. And looking at the person and has compassion for the person, right? Because they're under the power of their affliction, whatever it might be. So... And the analogy is that of a patient, okay? And so here it says, though a possessed patient rages at him, a physician will not be upset with this sick person of whom a demon has taken hold. Okay, a demon, it's like they're raging, and so they're totally out of control. And the person the physician is compassionate for the person, not looking at that, you know, that activity, and they're understanding that the person is totally under the power of this anger. Similarly, subduers see that because they make sentient beings unruly, the disturbing emotions in a trainee's mind stream are at fault, and not the person who has. So it's our activities, our unruliness, come out because we're under the control of something that we can't get control of, and the Buddhas have compassion for us, that they blame the affliction, the anger or the attachment or the jealousy or the competitiveness or all those, we call those the afflictions. And she's calling them the disturbing emotions because they disturb the mind, they cause the mind to be unpeaceful, and then we do things out of that, you know, based on those disturbing. Sometimes you can think of them negative emotions, right? We do actions out of those, and so then you don't blame the person. Another way this is expressed is, you know, everybody, in from the, this is what my teacher said, all my students are kind. It's just some of their activities, you know, what they do is not kind, right? Because you're under the control of these disturbing emotions, these negative emotions. So those who wish to take care or to guide trainees must learn to act like this. It is like the analogy of a lion who attacks the one who throws the weapon, not the weapon that is thrown. I think sometimes dogs go after the thing, they go after the weapon, but it seems lions are a little bit more intelligent. They go after who's throwing that weapon. Ouch! Hey, that's the guy who did it, you know. So then you have to go at not go after the action. You go after the disturbing emotion that caused the action, right? And there's a kind of obligation to help that person to be freed of that, of their disturbing emotion. The afflictions, the reason we call them disturbing emotions is because the afflictions, if you think about being jealous or being filled with pride or any of these, they cause the mind to be stirred up, okay? I mean, if you think of the mind as kind of being in a natural state, a kind of quiet, right? And then when you don't have that, it could just be like a quietness. But then when you're subject to this disturbing emotion or this negative emotion or destructive emotion, another way to think of it, then it causes the mind to be disturbed. And then the unpeaceful or sort of agitated, another different ways of thinking of it, like from those perspectives, and then you can see that through Buddhist practice, okay, if you oppose that destructive emotion, then instead of being angry with the person, if you're patient, right, and tolerant, then what happens is that the mind becomes relaxed and calm, and you feel a little bit, happier, some kind of sense of relief. And so then...
Not at first?
It's a struggle.
Trying to become tolerant, it's like...
It's hard to be, but if you can get that, if you can oppose that attitude with a different its opposite, okay, if because it's so uncomfortable, right, to be proud, and to be jealous, these are things that are very uncomfortable, and if you can through applying what we call the countermeasure in Buddhism, if you can counteract that, then you can see the mind becoming peaceful. Even to when it becomes, like you're saying, you're really intolerant of somebody and your mind gets all stirred up, you can change your focus to your breath. If it's so strong, then if you just focus on your breathing and the breath coming in, the breath going out, just taking your being aware that you don't want to be there and focus on something else brings some peace to the mind. And that's especially when it's really strong, it's really hard to do something about it. But if you can become aware of it, that you're under it, and then you can just switch your attention to the breathing. Breathe in, breathe out, Then it's through that that process, the mind calms down. Okay, and then you can maybe think more rationally about what's going on. You know, you can get yourself into a more rational approach. Having children, as you might well know, right? But I think that the Buddha, Buddhism is basically that. Okay, I mean, if you think about that in the morning, think about when you get up, you know, how if we are under the influence of some kind of a disturbing emotion or afflictive emotion, that the mind my mind is disturbed, unrelaxed, you know, agitated, you know, and then if I can apply some kind of a countermeasure, it becomes relaxed and I become happier. It's a kind of a relief, right? And then, so if you think, well, that must mean that disciplining my mind is a transformative practice. It's a way to really transform my experience such that I will be happier if I do this, right? A transformative experience, transformative practice means that if I train myself and discipline my mind to do this all the time, it would really transform me. I would be a happier person, you know. And so then if you think there's 7 billion people in the world, and some people would say, well, that's a bunch of bunk, you know. I'm going to be angry anyway, you know, and I get what I want that way, you know. And the other people, maybe, you know, Buddhists would say, oh, no, that sounds right, you know. And then you see that the people who reject it then are totally involved in their afflictive emotions, and they're never peaceful and happy, and they're causing a lot of trouble for others as well. You know, it's a sad thing. We all know people who do like that. And then there are people who for the most part, who practice Buddhism, and for the most part, they're able to be peaceful. And so then you say, oh. Well, it seems that, you know, this is a worthwhile transformative practice, you know, and so I'll do that. You know, you can make some determination to do that on a daily basis. If you have to reflect on it, though, if you don't reflect on it and make some determination, then when things come up, you're not going to, you know, apply the countermeasure with as much force, you know, because you'll be caught off guard. But if you sort of prepare yourself with some kind of morning, you know, what do you say? We used to get psyched up before, you know.
Mental rehearsal.
Mental rehearsal, and you know, it's some kind of a, you know, like before a game, we'd get all psyched up. You got to get yourself
pep
psyched
rally.
Up. Yeah, pep rally, a personal pep rally in the morning. And then you can oppose these afflictions during the day, you know, and then you'll develop some kind of a sense of mental discipline, you know, and self-discipline, maybe we could think of it that way. And then you gradually, over time, Solnes usually says, I don't know, after 5 years of doing like that, if you see that you should be able to look back and say, oh, gee, you know, I wasn't a very peaceful and happy person 5 years ago, but I've been doing this, and gee, I seem a lot more peaceful and happy now. So then that's the way you sort of get confidence that Buddhist practice has some value to you, and it's worthwhile for you to make effort at. And then you can, so this Holiness talks about this one verse in this context. He says, you can make a kind of determination, day and night I will use this body of mine, day and night, I will make good use of this body of mine, which is a home of illness, the basis for the suffering of old age, and lacks a core like a bubble. It's from, I can't remember which book it is in, but that particular phrase, I think it's from the great treatise on the stage of the path.
Okay.
It appears in the, I remembered translating it. I can't remember what page.
Where it is
now. Yeah, where it was. I haven't been able to find it. But then you can make that kind of determination to engage in that kind of transformative practice. I like that because, you know, I'm going to make good use of this body of mine, which is not a great thing, but I can still use it for some good use, you know. I'll put it to good use, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know, we're going to the end of the class here. Does anybody have any? We don't have the right time anywhere. I've got it in front of me. 3:03 is what I've got.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
If anybody had any
questions,
anybody have any questions? If you'd like to ask a question.
Can you repeat the quote one more time, Josh?
Yeah. Day and night, I will make good use of this body of mine, which is a home of illness, the basis for the suffering of old age, and lacks a core like a bubble. There's nothing to it. You know, we tend to think there's something there, real substance to it, but it doesn't.
One more time.
Day and night, I will make good use of this body of mine, which is a home of illness, the basis for the suffering of old age. And lacks a core like a bubble. I can't remember which one. It was one of the recent books. It wasn't How to Practice.
Josh?
Yeah.
You talked about remembering your breath in a moment when you realize you're sort of gone into anger or pride or jealousy.
Yeah.
Is there something that you do also to help remember that it's not the person, but it's their afflicted emotion that is causing the trouble, like the, you know, lion example?
About the person. You have to be able to separate out the person from their afflictive emotion. Maybe that's difficult unless you think about, you know, you have to sort of think about, well, what is the person, right? It's probably, you know, like different kinds of ways of thinking about the person and the afflictive emotions. You have to understand that you have to reflect about your own experience about the afflictive emotions and how you're never really becoming angry by your own choice, you know, and it's never your choice. There, it's an impulse that comes, right, and then you have to deal with that impulse. And it's how you deal with it, right? If some people are able to, you know, squash it down, repress it, and other people are able to identify it and oppose it, right? And then also So then it has to be in your own experience, right? You have to be able to identify it in your own experience, and how then it's what causes you to do things that you don't want to do. We're always doing things that we regret because we weren't aware of certain, that we were under the influence of a certain negative state of mind or emotion, and so we didn't take care of it, and then we say something that we regret, right? Or we do something that we regret, and then we go, oh, well, where did that come from, right? And it's because we weren't aware that we were under the influence of that particular state of mind that brought about that negative action. And so then you really have to be developing, you know, an awareness of your own emotional, all of your emotions, really. And you have to become self-aware. So that's why, you know, there's a big emphasis on mindfulness training in Buddhism. Mindfulness is really talking about developing an awareness, you know, and you have to train your mind to be aware. And then once you're aware in that way and you see how the afflictions are operating within you, it's easy to then have empathy for others, you know. Otherwise, if you just weren't aware, there might be a tendency to say that it's, you know, they should be able to control themselves. Or something.
Well, it's their fault.
Yeah, it's their fault. You blame them, you know, and you'd sort of, you know, instead of, you know, being like the lion, right, you know, instead of going after the real cause of the problem, you'll just, you know, you'll be the, going after the victim of the cause, you know, the person who's, you know, you know, the person we tend to think of as being all-powerful, but, you know, because we have this misunderstanding of ourselves as being independent, you know, and I'm able to do everything I want, you know, and, you know, and but actually you're just sort of like a leaf in the wind, you know, being blown around by these other influences. So then, you know, we have to have some understanding like that so that we can have some empathy for others who you know, are under the control of their afflictions, you know, when they do things that are harmful to others. And so then when you start making the afflictions your enemy, that's what in Buddhism, the afflictions are really the enemy. It's not the external enemy. And so when you have that attitude that you're, like I'm talking about developing in the morning, this determination to counteract the afflictions, then the afflictions become the enemy and people don't become the enemy. It has to be a training, though. If you don't do these kinds of things over and over again, it's not going to just come out of thin air. You know, you're not going to be able to pull this out of thin air. You have to train yourself and become more aware, think about these things on a daily basis, and that's why we have the teachings. You know, you have to devote some time to reading the teachings. You know, there's a very good book that Jeffrey has just come out with, How to Be Compassionate. He translated His Holiness's teachings on how to be compassionate, and it's talking about, you know, bringing the afflictions under control and developing compassion for others, because it's really coming from compassion that this verse is talking about, where you really have a concern for the other person being under the control of their affliction that's giving them so much trouble. You know, it's really they're under the control of their anger or their hatred, and they have no, you know, they have no way of getting out from under that influence. So it's really something that you can have compassion for. And then once you have that compassion, it opens up this situation where then you can have that, you know, ability to say, oh, well, they're, you know, it's not the person, it's the affliction. And when we're talking about the Buddha having this attitude, then we're talking about somebody who's very advanced. That's the perfect person, that's the ideal view. So it's an ideal that you're working towards, right? It's not like all of us can have that right off the bat. But you do have to train. It's not going to come out of thin air. That's all. You do have to train yourself. That's why I thought, you know, if you have this determination in the morning, you know, to counteract the afflictions, like it's only as it's saying, it's a good practice, right? Good way of getting yourself oriented towards opposing the afflictions.
Hey, Josh.
Yeah.
Good. Talking about the disciplining the mind as a transformative practice. A very interesting book by Richard Davidson, from a scientific point of view, just came out. This is.
Oh.
The book. It's called The Emotional Life of Your Brain.
Ah.
And you know, he goes back to his meetings with the Dalai Lama, and from a scientific point of view, working on very interesting theories about the way that your brain is constructed and how it relates to afflictive emotions and things like that.
Yeah.
Just started to read it. I think it's a very interesting book, and you know, Richard Davidson is.
Yeah.
I think the Dalai Lama says that he refers to him as one of his teachers.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Richard Davidson, The Emotional Life of the Brain, is that what it is? Yeah.
Yes, the Emotional Life of Your Brain.
Yeah, of your brain. Yeah. And this is another example of, you know, that we're not so mind oriented, we're more brain oriented in this culture. So it's a good it's a good way to, you know, like I get up in the morning and I say, my brain is really foggy today, you know, when in fact my mind is really foggy, right? My brain's not working, you know. But then, so you know, it's good to read that. Yeah, thanks, Fred. That's a good book. Richard Davidson is, you know, sort of spearheading, I guess, this scientific approach, which he calls contemplative science. Which is probably not real science.
Not yet.
In the view of many scientists. Yeah. But anyway, he's started a whole institute at the University of Wisconsin. Yeah. So I think it's well worth, you know, His Holiness is very excited about doing that kind of, you know, it's some kind of a bridge, right? It might not be accepted by a lot of scientists, but for some scientists who are thinking on the edge, like my Christian friend thinking on the edge of, you know, being a Christian, you know. Some people are like that. You know.
Nothing happens till you get out on the edge.
Right? Yeah, right. Right. Yeah, things are kind of dead in the middle there. Right?
The core of a bubble.
Yeah, right.
Well, psychiatry wasn't accepted, 50,
75
years ago.
It still probably isn't accepted by some people. Kathy was saying psychiatry wasn't accepted as a science, years ago as well. But it's probably still people who don't accept it.
Josh, I have a little example. When I was a schoolboy, there was a boy in our class who regularly had epileptic seizures, and they were very frightening to everybody. And to him too. And the school nurse came in one day and gave us a little talk on what was going on. And that was very helpful because he was a very nice fellow, but he would just, and sometimes when we'd be on a field trip, he'd have a seizure, and it was annoying that would happen, but we got used to it. Well, I kind of have taken that, and I find that I look at people sometimes and saying, oh, he's having an anger seizure.
That's a good analogy.
She's having a lust seizure.
Yeah, right.
Whatever, you know, name the affliction.
They don't have any control over it.
Yeah. Sometimes people have them all the time.
That's a good one. Yeah, thanks, Rick. Yeah. No, that's true. It's really true. It's like having a seizure. Yeah, I had somebody like that in elementary school, but we never had the school nurse. I think the school nurse was like the Buddha, right? or one of the Buddha's followers coming in and helping you to become aware of it. We just thought, oh, she's so strange, you know. It was Temple Grandin, actually, you know, from... She was the autistic person. Yeah, she would behave very, you know, strangely, and the whole school would get disturbed, right? Mm-hmm. But we had no explanation for it, probably because the school nurse didn't have
she
any
was
explanation.
In the school?
Yeah,
she's an autistic who received a PhD.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. There was a film made about it.
Yeah, she teaches
a
Colorado.
Yeah, that was a great film. Yeah, but it's similar to your experience, but I'd lacked that school nurse. If we had that school nurse, it would have been, I'm understanding that she was a bodhisattva, or he was a bodhisattva, I don't know.
No, she was a bodhisattva, there was no doubt about it. Time and time again, she helped intervene in the life of people. As a matter of fact, our class started to defend him with other classes after a while, because he'd have these on the school ground, and then we kind of got involved in explaining that and, protecting him.
Oh, that's marvelous. Yeah.
Just had this terrible thing. Well, there's an awful lot of people who just have all these anger seizures all the time, or frustration seizures.
Yeah, right.
Whatever.
Yeah.
It's helpful. Think that way.
It is helpful.
I don't always do it.
Yeah, right. Especially when you're on the brunt of it. You know?
You got it. You're right.
It's one thing to see somebody else go, oh, yeah, you know, if it's getting hit, you know, that's
coming at you.
Yeah, that's Genla's. Genla's, you know, example of how we hold on to our, you know, cells as a, you know, this strong sense of I am, you know. When somebody else is getting yelled at, you go, oh, yeah, that's interesting. But then when they start saying those nasty things to you, you know, oh, yeah, you're saying it to me, you know.
Well, yeah.
You got this strong sense of me, right? You're talking to me. Where is that? Where is that me? In Buddhism, then we'd analyze where that me was. So anyway, I think we should stop now. It's getting late. And we'll dedicate. We have these two verses at the bottom. I dedicate all this virtue to emulate the knowledge of the hero Manjushri and likewise Samantabhadra as well. With whatever dedication is praised as supreme by all the conquerors who traverse the three times, I also dedicate all my roots of virtue for the sake of auspicious deeds.
Thank you, Josh.
Thank you, everyone. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to teach.
Are you teaching again next week?
You're welcome.
Are you teaching again next week? Or?
Oh, yeah, I'll be teaching again next week.
Okay.
I'm kind of on a... quasi-retreat is one of my gurus. But I'll be teaching next week. So, well, thank you all.
Okay.
I guess I'll see you later out in Hawaii and down in Charlottesville and where's everybody in Philadelphia and
thank
Montclair.
You.
See you.
Our love to you and I.